in the corner, back by the Woodpile Podcast. I'm Spawn Counter Guy. Recently, I met a guy named Joe in upstate New York who, with his wife, basically lived in a small room, in spite of the fact that he had two houses. I reckon that's what happens when you have as many books as Joe does. Anyway, most of these books were about history, and Joe's just about read them all. So I took him back by the woodpile, and we had some talks.
Growing up in the Mohawk Valley of New York, Schenectady, New York here, we are just a few miles west of Albany on Interstate 90, which kind of follows the path of the Western Migration and the Erie Canal. But before there was an Erie Canal, there was a Mohawk River, which was the path to the Great Lakes in Buffalo, New York, the Queen City, as they once called it. And it was the route of trade in the Western to the Western Empire. Okay, and we became known once as, you know, the Empire State here in New York, because through New York ran the entire empire. So any trade with the West came right through Schenectady, the Mohawk River, the Erie Canal, out to the Great Lakes, eventually to Chicago, and points west. Well, in the mid-1700s was a gentleman named William Johnson, and he's known today in some places around here as Sir Bill. And William Johnson was a young Irishman who came over to administer his uncle Peter Warren's estate, his land grant. And when he did that as a young man, he became a very beloved member, adopted into the Mohawk Indian tribe, which is part of the Iroquois Confederacy. The Iroquois Confederacy were five Iroquoian tribes who were known as the most powerful tribes in America at the time. And Sir William Johnson, as he became to be known, was just a commoner who was able to maintain the neutrality of the Iroquois tribes during the French and Indian War. Probably without his assistance for on behalf of the throne, we would all be speaking French, and this would be a French colony or a French speaking nation, because Johnson was able to keep the Iroquois not only from attacking the English, he got them to fight against the French. And at the Battle of Lake George, Johnson became a hero, and he was knighted by the king, became a baron, became Sir William Johnson, and he became the administrator of Indian affairs in North America, and probably the most powerful Englishman in North America. He died on the eve of the Revolution, and at which point the Native American tribes of the Iroquois found themselves split. He was not, if he were alive during the Revolution, he may have been able to turn the Iroquois against the American colonist on behalf of the king. Yet he died before the Revolution, a few years before it began, and because of that, the Iroquois were split, and the Oneida fought on the side of the American colonist against the throne, and the entire Iroquois nation was divided. And as a result of the later the Sullivan expedition that George Washington sent up through the Susquehanna Valley, he defeated the Iroquois and the divided Iroquois and prevented them from conquering New York, upstate New York, and we won the Revolution. So there's a lot of history there that people don't know about. It's not really taught in schools. It's not focused upon. But I find William Johnson to be one of the most intriguing pre-revolutionary colonial figures in America.
Is he the one you said he had his way with several Indian girls?
Had his way. It was said that he had over 200 Indian children.
Whoa.
In the Iroquois way, it was a matrilineal society, so it didn't matter who your father was as much as it mattered who your mother was. And he went from village to village, and he was feeded. He was known, his Iroquoian name was Wariaji, which meant the doer of great things. He was beloved, and he became an adopted member of the Mohawk tribe of the Iroquois nations, and he had many, many ladies, bore children into the Indian world, and he even had a wife named Molly Brandt, whose father was a war chief, And he was very important. Basically, he was Native American royalty. Okay, so he's a guy that I like to think about as being really an interesting character and a figure that we don't often appreciate.
What about an event, Mark?
Oh, an event. Okay, here's a good one. The most powerful Indian nation east of the Mississippi was the Shawnee Indians of Ohio and Indiana. And, of course, their power was felt as far east as Philadelphia and as far west as the Mississippi. And they were greatly feared. They were considered one of the most warlike, powerful tribes. They were eventually, Tecumseh was a Shawnee. They were eventually divided into two. The tribe was divided into two by a fight between two women over a cooking pot. And the two women fought in their main village in Ohio, and they had an argument. This dates back several hundred years, and this was said in their oral history as the reason why their tribe divided in two. And when their tribe divided in two, they became very, very much less powerful than they could have been in stopping the white man's westward progression in the late 1700s and early 1800s. So I always get a kick out of that. Oftentimes I hear the expression that if women ran the world, we'd have nothing but peace. But I oftentimes think of the the poor Shawnee and the fight over the two women in the cooking pot dividing up the entire nation. So that's, again, a little politically incorrect, but it's always an interesting tale.
And you love World War II?
Yeah, well, I love the history of World War II, for
so
sure.
So what is... Why do you love World War II?
I hate World War II, yeah. That it ever happened. Of course, one of the worst events in world history, but the history is very interesting. Well, I have a lot of theories, and I don't know if they're always shared by all historians, but I've always maintained that if Hitler was able to rise to power without his insane racism and anti-Semitism, and he was able to coalesce power for the Nazi regime without the Jews as a scapegoat, and he was able to have the Jews in German society as part of his regime, rather than being his, having made them into the scapegoat, the enemy, and the victim that he eventually did. And he never carried out the Holocaust, and he never carried out racial extermination, and he never carried on such an insane racist theory of a supreme race and we're going to destroy the Jews and such, that he would have won World War II. And the reason for that is, I have multiple reasons for that. We can point to Operation Barbarossa, where he attacked Russia, and he was eventually, he was early on, he was very successful, and Germans were greeted as conquering heroes who would come to liberate Ukraine. But once the special, Holocaust units came in to behind the German advance, the spearheads, they began rounding up the Jews and rounding up the dissidents and rounding up the gypsies and killing and murdering people and waging Holocaust, basically genocide, on the local population. And they quickly lost their popularity and they turned the locals against the Germans, who were there, they originally saw as heroes and, liberators. That's an easy example to point out. The second I can point is that he basically took the Jewish scientists, fled Germany in the 30s. They got out of there and they went to the West. And many of them eventually took up residence in the United States and Britain. They were able to help our war efforts. Some of the most intelligent minds of Europe fled Europe because of this insane Nazi way. And then the last thing,
including Einstein,
can't be understated.
Yeah.
The last thing I point out is the amount of vast war materials, manpower, munitions, train lines, transportation efforts, that was put into this insane Holocaust to kill 13 million people in death camps. It's a number we probably use today. It's about 13 million. The amount that he invested into that, and the Hitler invested into that crazy scheme, every bit of that had to come from the war effort. Okay, so we might also be speaking German, if this guy didn't have these insane racial theories. So it was a matter of him detracting from his own war efforts with this madness, and I've always maintained that.
What's one of the most humorous things that you've come across in history?
I oftentimes laugh about when the Liberty Bell rang in Philadelphia at the conclusion of the Revolution, that the people went around smashing all the windows of the Quakers. You know, it doesn't sound funny, but in a way, it was like, see, we told you we were going to win. The Quakers decided to be neutral, and, you know, they didn't want war, and, you know, it's kind of like they felt like, well, we don't need to have a war. We can give up our freedom. And the people went around and broke their windows, you know. It's kind of like, geez, not a really nice thing, but I always kind of got a chuckle out of it. You know, I sure hope they didn't hurt anybody, but the reports at the time where they went around and broke all their windows, so.
I'm just a mild fan of history. I mean, I love it, but I'm not an expert by any means. But it's very difficult for me to watch historical movies, because especially if you know a little bit and you see how much
The butchery of the truth.
Yeah. And does that bother you?
No, I'm a film lover. I love cinema, and I'm a believer in the auteur theory, which says that the director is the artist, and you kind of let him run. And I certainly understand.
Even if it's completely untrue.
Yeah, because as long as they explain that with a disclaimer, I feel, you know, look at the movie The Patriot, for instance. Yeah. You know, you can enjoy historical fiction, you know, and you can do it in books, so you should be able to do it with movies.
Okay.
Of course, the movie Pearl Harbor. I mean, you know.
Have you watched that?
I've seen it. Yeah, anything that comes out in World War II, good or bad, I always check it out. And, you know, sometimes I just roll my eyes. One of my favorite World War II movies is Patton.
Uh-huh.
You know, and it's not really a war movie per se, but a movie, it's a biopic. And I've always enjoyed it. And I've watched it a couple dozen times.
Yeah.
And being probably a student of General Patton's. And so I certainly, you know, there's good and there's bad. And, you know, I've seen every John Wayne movie, I guess, you know, post-war John Wayne movie anyway. I'm not a big fan of his work in the 30s. The Republic movies that he made, you know, three in a week, you know. Those are B-movies. But I certainly have, you know, you have to take it all with a grain of salt. I've seen the John Ford movies, and, you know, some say they glorify war. I think they glorify the warrior ethic more than they glorify war.
All right. Anything else about history you want to say?
No.
Become history?
No, I will not be anything noted in history. But you know, history is just so underappreciated. And sometimes I get upset with the History Channel as to what it's become. We talk about it. You know, it's got reality shows and the Pickers and the Pawn Stars. But I guess what they do is, for a dumbed down audience, they take these historical artifacts and they use them to explain historical events.
Yeah.
And but it's frustrating to a hardcore buff who remembers when the History Channel came on, you could watch stories about World War II and the Civil War and the Revolution basically 24 hours a day. So I miss that stuff.
In your opinion, what is the advantage of knowing history?
It helps you understand everything in today's context. And I certainly also, and my biggest pet peeve, and I probably should, you know, you didn't ask me, but I'm going to tell you what
no,
it is, is judging yesterday's people by today's mores and norms.
We'll talk about that real quick.
My biggest pet peeve. They found out that Romney had his dog on the roof in 1983 in a pet crate and drove across the country with
Mitt Romney,
the presidential candidate of 2012. And they were so appalled by that, not recognizing that 30 years ago that such behavior was normal. Today's standards, pets are part of our family, and they're loved, and they live inside. It wasn't that long ago where people's dogs lived outside in a doghouse or chained to a tree four seasons a year, 12 months a year. And they were utilitarian critters. They were like livestock, okay? I mean, they had some level of companionship, but they were there on the farm to work or to guard or to herd. And people don't understand that today's mores and norms are different. Nobody blows smoke in a baby's face today. But 40 years ago, it was typical that you would smoke a cigarette while your infant was in your arms, okay? And 50 years ago, it was not considered evil or wrong or an aberration. No one understood the harmful effects of secondhand smoke that like they do now. You can't judge what people did 50 or 100 or 200 years ago based on today's standards. Yet people constantly do it.
Yeah.
Whether it's homophobia, for instance, that's another one.
Yeah.
Racial discrimination and use of racial epithets, for instance,
right,
were commonplace.
Yeah.
Okay, 100 years ago. It didn't make everyone evil. It was the moray and the standard of the times.
Yeah. Can I play devil's advocate? Like,
yeah.
So, I guess, of course, the one that America's most sensitive about is probably slavery. I assume you're not saying that it was morally right at the time.
It was considered morally acceptable. Yet, at the time of the Revolution, it was beginning to be viewed as unacceptable. Okay? And it was the evangelical Christians who identified it as an evil. Okay? And eventually were successful in abolishing slavery, abolishing the transporting of slaves and the sale of slaves. And then by the time of the 1860s, we certainly had a civil war, in large part due to states' rights concerning the ownership of slaves and slavery. So I consider the fact that people held slaves, that was an ancient tradition. It took only a few hundred years. It was only a few hundred years ago that people began realizing it was wrong.
Yeah. And when you say people, you mean the entire world?
Yes. I mean, certain places it still exists. However, you know, if we go back in time 1,000 years, it was such a common experience. And, you know, people who are Slavic, Polish, and Czechoslovak, means slave.
Yeah.
It means slave. And they were held as slaves by their enemies, okay? Mm-hmm. By the Romans and such. This was a common thing. But what happened is it took time for people to be enlightened. And we're constantly evolving in our mores and our values and our views. And Christianity, you can deride it. It's often derided today, but it was the impetus behind abolition, behind the woman's suffrage, behind even prohibition and you know, eliminating drugs and alcohol, okay, which was unsuccessful. But it was the Christians who decided, you know, this is a bad thing, we shouldn't do this, and we should free these people. And it was their movement which brought this about, first in England and then in America eventually. But I certainly believe that, you know, to say, oh, look at Jefferson and Washington, what terrible people. But even in their lifetime, Washington freed his slaves when he died, and he realized in his old age that if there was to be a war over slavery, he would side against Virginia. It was in his writings that he would side on the side of freedom. So certainly people, that was a time of evolving societal norms and values. And we still are going through evolving norms and values all the time.
Right. You're saying people look back on us and think, oh man, what idiots.
Well, here's what they're gonna do. When, you know, in 50 years, they're gonna consider us to be such environmental criminals that we actually had books on paper, that we killed trees, that we used chemicals to make paper, and we put these things on our shelves, and it was environmental terrorism that we did so, okay? And now, then everything will be on some type of computer format or up on a wall and a projector, or you could look at it through your eyeglasses.
Yeah.
As technology progresses, but we will be considered environmental terrorists. And the idea that we had paper books and libraries of paper books that cost, you know, this world so many trees, they'll think we were madmen. Okay, and that will be their view of us in maybe 20 or 30 years.
Yeah.
I say 50, but it might be 30. I believe that'll be one of the big things. They'll look back at us as just terrible, terrible people for having paper books.
All right. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
In the Corner, Back by the Woodpile podcast is produced by A Closet, A Pocket, and A Suitcase. You can email us at spuncounterguy@hotmail.com. And a special thanks to thebrofisticate.com.